50 years ago, President Johnson announced the war on poverty and launched a number of government programs, including Medicare, Medicaid, aid to universities and technical colleges, food stamps, the Job Corps, and more. Later on today, President Obama is scheduled to make a speech where he is going to unveil things like promise zones. We'll talk about that. He's going to address income inequality. In 2014, or so the White House says, we're going to discuss that this morning on the Ideas Network and get your take on what the president is proposing. My guest is Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation, which researches social inequality, low-wage work, immigration, and behavioral economics. He's also written several books, including Legacies of the War on Poverty, which came out last year. Sheldon Danziger, welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Good morning.
So I'm going to start with the big question first. It's not something I usually do in an interview, but this one is just so big it needs to be up front, I think. How is it that here in the United States, spoken of as the richest country in the world, that we can have as much poverty as we do, but other European countries that maybe aren't quite as well off have less poverty? Why is it that we still have so much poverty in the midst of so much abundance here in the United States?
Well, that's an excellent question, and if you'll let me read you a quote from President Johnson's declaration 50 years ago, you will see that's exactly the reason he declared war on poverty. Quote, "Americans today enjoy the highest standard living in the history of mankind, but for nearly a fifth of our fellow citizens, this is a hollow achievement. We cannot and need not wait for the gradual growth of the economy to lift this forgotten fifth of our nation above the poverty line." So that motivated the war on poverty 50 years ago. I think the simple answer to the question is Americans like to think of themselves as compassionate, but other countries care more about their disadvantaged citizens. So you just have to go a little bit north to Canada, and you'll find out that Canada does more for its disadvantaged citizens. It has a higher minimum wage. It does more to support public schools so that the schools are less unequal than our public schools are. It's had national health insurance for decades. So we as a country fear government intervention, and in doing so, it shows we care less about the poor.
Well, we could spend all hour talking about that, but we have other things to talk about. I wanted to raise that right at the front end, because any discussion of poverty, that question, I think, needs to be asked. So this afternoon, President Obama is scheduled to address some ways to reduce America's income gap. Income inequality has become kind of headline news. Even though it's been around a while, but all of a sudden people are paying attention to it. Given that we're coming off the 50-year anniversary of President Johnson's call to wage war on poverty, which you just talked about, what do you expect President Obama to say this afternoon?
Well, I expect President Obama's goals to be more modest than those of President Johnson. We live in a different time. Certain things that are almost universally agreed as being good to promote mobility and opportunity and reduce inequality would include something like universal pre-K or early childhood education for all the poor. Many countries do that. The president has proposed it. But we live in a world in which Congress just says no. So I think the president is likely to propose a lot of reasonable policies, raising the minimum wage. That was one of the things President Johnson did 50 years ago as part of the war on poverty. And, of course, in terms of preschool education, President Johnson's war on poverty gave us head start. So I would think that two of the things that the president will propose today are things that were done by President Johnson. President Johnson had no trouble getting Congress to raise the minimum wage.
Well, he had a pretty tame Congress. I mean, let's agree on that.
He did have have a pretty tame Congress. He won a very large landslide in 1964 and was certainly able to push through an enormous amount of legislation. And that's really the focus of our book, is how President Johnson changed the safety net. And in some sense, there has been a backlash for the last 40 or so years against the expansion of the safety net. So you'll see today, or you just have to pick up the Wall Street Journal yesterday, or listen to Marco Rubio, there is a mantra on the right that says the safety net failed, and that's what the war on poverty was about. But that neglects the fact that the war on poverty gave us Medicare and Medicaid and what's become Pell Grants to provide funds for low-income students to go to college, all things which we didn't have. So I think President Obama will try to do some of the same things on a reduced scale that President Johnson proposed.
Those who oppose the expansion of the safety net argue that people should be self-sufficient and get out of poverty on their own terms.
Everybody agrees with that. That's exactly right.
But how do you get there?
Well, they have it backwards. They say, oh, look, there are all these people who are on the safety net. If certain firms that have made billions of dollars by paying their workers low wages would raise their wages, then fewer people would get food stamps and Medicaid and the earned income tax credit and be part of what candidate Romney called the 47%. So it's ironic. The reason so many people are poor is because they work for low wages. And many firms, I need not name a famous one, encourages its workers to go out and get food stamps and Medicaid because they don't provide health insurance and pay enough to their workers. So it's not the safety net that's failed. It's the economy that failed. 50 years ago, it really was the case that a rising tide lifted all boats. And President Johnson's advisors recognized that. And they thought, you know, even though a rising tide is lifting all boats, we still need a focus on those at the bottom who are being left behind. Today, it's not just the poor who are being left behind, it's the middle class. And real wages of many workers are not increasing. I saw a quote in the paper where Marco Rubio says he doesn't want people to earn $10 an hour, he wants people to earn $50 an hour. I don't know where he's getting his data. But men who work full-time, full year in the U.S. today, that's everybody, including college graduates and more, the median wage is around $25 an hour. The median annual earnings is about $50,000, which translates into about $25 an hour, and a quarter of workers earn less than $12 an hour. So it's the economy that's failed, not the safety net.
We're going to continue our conversation in just a bit, and when we continue it, I want to talk a little bit about what President Obama is calling promise zones. He's expected to unveil them for San Antonio, Philadelphia, and other poor areas in the United States. He spoke about those in the State of the Union address, and we'll talk about them in just a moment. And we'll take your calls and questions as well at 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or your comments on the Joy Cardin Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardin. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. The war on poverty continues under the leadership of President Obama, who's expected to give a speech later today where he'll outline his plans for 2014 and how to deal with things like income inequality. We're talking about that this morning on the Ideas Network. Good morning. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardin. My guest is Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation. And you can join us as well at 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or find us on Facebook. What do you think the next phase of the war on poverty should look like? Or Should we just give up and go home? How confident are you in these promise zones the president is talking about? And should the federal minimum wage be raised? Those are all good questions to discuss this hour on the Ideas Network. So, Sheldon Danziger, President Obama is going to unveil what he calls promise zones in San Antonio, Philadelphia, and other poor areas of the United States in his speech today. The primary focus is supposed to be on job creation, housing, law enforcement, and education. So, what do you make of all of this? Are there other things besides the four things I just mentioned that should also be included?
Well, there are two issues that I emphasize here. One is poverty is pervasive across the country. So we have very high poverty rates in central cities, suburbs, and rural areas. And workers with a high school degree or less have been struggling with their wages and hours for decades. I don't need to tell people in Wisconsin about the effect of plant closings. Inner cities have extremely high poverty rates, in part because over the past four decades, there's been a lot of flight from the central cities. So we often have the concentrations of very poor people in areas with little opportunities for some of the people left behind. The high-wage jobs in the central cities tend to be taken by people who often live in the suburbs. So focusing on inner cities goes back to the war on poverty. It goes back to Jack Kemp. It goes back to President Clinton's enterprise zones. And I don't know the details of what the president's going to say today, but from what you said, there has always been an attempt to use the power of government to encourage growth in central cities. Certain things the federal government can do. I remember under Bill Clinton, one of the things that he did was provide extra funding for community policing in high crime area in central cities. That the federal government can do relatively easily. Getting firms to relocate is very difficult because what often happens, states do this all the time. They say, okay, we're going to give you an incentive to locate in City X, and then a firm decides, okay, I'm just going to move from City Y to City X. That doesn't necessarily create new jobs. So,
well, that becomes kind of a zero-sum game.
That's certainly the case. We've seen it in the news recently with whether Boeing was going to leave the state of Washington. Boeing was going to build the same number of planes, and the only question was where is it going to build? So when people talk about let's make the business conditions here more conducive, there's a great concern that it will just lead to substitution. But I think there certainly may be ways to do that, and I'll hold judgment until I actually see what's in the promise zone. One of the notions of the promise zone, I think, comes from the Harlem Children's Zone in New York City, where within a given area they have really focused on schooling. And so you go into an area which is disadvantaged and you provide extra services to those kids. So in the Harlem Children's Zone, they have something called Baby College, where they start with young mothers and their babies and provide early education, and then there's a lot of preschool and after-school education. So it may be that the promise zones will also include an education component, and it's well recognized that poor schools in central cities have less resources and more troubled students and less qualified teachers than more affluent areas, and at least the Harlem Children's Zone has demonstrated that there's a way to use resources to help turn some of those disadvantages around.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join the program. We're talking with Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation, this morning. President Obama is expected to outline his plans to continue the war on poverty in a speech he'll give later today. That is the genesis of this program. And we're wondering what you think. We've got some calls coming in. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones and hear what George in Milwaukee has to say this morning. George, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Especially in relationship to trying to get more jobs into the economy, that's probably going to help end poverty or lessen it the most. I would like to suggest that the president and the Democrats start talking about how we need to share the wealth. And one way to do it is to put a surcharge of perhaps 10% on the taxes of maybe the top 10 or 20% of income earners until the unemployment level goes down below a certain point, say 5% or something like that, and then dedicate those funds to things like, job training, unemployment compensation, and so on.
George, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Sheldon Danziger?
Well, it reminded me that when President Johnson declared war on poverty, he unfortunately also launched a war in Vietnam, which took some attention away from the war on poverty. And at the time, there was a surtax on income. I think it was a 10% income increase for everybody. But one of the reasons that gets left off the table is if we had done that for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we would have a lot more revenue today to pay for some of the social programs that the caller just mentioned. So there's a lot of focus on the deficit, but a large chunk of the deficit comes because we fought some unfunded wars and we had these huge tax cuts during the Bush era. So certainly the experience during the Clinton administration, where taxes were raised at the top and the earned income tax credit was expanded at the bottom, would be perfectly consistent with what the caller suggests. Unfortunately, I think it was difficult for President Clinton to get that modest tax increase through in the early 1990s. As I recall, it was 50-50 in the Senate, and Al Gore broke the tie. And so it's become much more difficult. In fact, the biggest problem preventing any major social programs is the Republicans have a no new taxes mantra. And if it's economic growth that has failed the poor and you can't spend more money on social programs, then the only way you can raise incomes at the bottom through the government is to do things like raise the minimum wage. Or, as I said, the Republicans should encourage some of their large donors to pay their workers better.
Well, and I mean, part of the problem here, and we don't want to spend the hour talking economic policy necessarily, but part of the problem here is that there's no demand. And so there's no reason to hire anybody because you don't sell any more stuff. If you hire more people, who's going to buy it? And Ben Bernanke, outgoing Fed chair, had some harsh criticism for the austerity policies at the federal and state level as being some of the things that have slowed economic growth in the United States. Those are elements of policy that the president doesn't necessarily have much control over. That has to happen from Congress.
Well, that's correct, and Chairman Bernanke is certainly not a radical economist, but I think almost all economists believe that austerity is bad. And here's an example of the problem. For many years, I always thought talking about infrastructure was boring. It was just, something the government did. But for about 20 years, we've let the infrastructure go. What would have been a better time to rebuild bridges? There are bridges falling down in every congressional district than during the last 4 or 5 years when the unemployment rate is high and the interest rate is virtually zero. So you could, the federal government could have primed the pump and expanded lots of jobs. As I said, you can think of early childhood education, which I expect will be part of the president's proposals. Early childhood education is investment in the future, but you also have to hire a lot of preschool teachers in every congressional district. So things that shouldn't be politically controversial would increase jobs, but you can't do it unless there's a way to spend the money.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation, about President Obama's conduct of the war on poverty. And the president will be delivering a speech this afternoon. He'll be unveiling promise zones and other initiatives in 2014 designed to address issues like income inequality here in the U.S. of A. Wondering what you think about all of this? 800-642-1234, the number to call. 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Fifty years ago, President Johnson launched the war on poverty, creating programs like the Peace Corps, Head Start, Medicare, Medicaid, the Pell Grants, lots of other stuff. This afternoon, President Obama is expected to give a speech where he outlines his plans to continue the battle against poverty. We've talked about promise zones this morning. We'll continue to discuss what might be done in the president's second term to help fight poverty in America. My guest, Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation, which researches social inequality, low-wage work, immigration, and behavioral economics. He's also written several books, including Legacies of the War on Poverty, which came out last year. Well, Sheldon Danziger, the two of the things, programs that President Johnson's administration created, Medicaid and Medicare. Let's talk about those 50 years on. They were both criticized sharply. Medicare got about the same kind of criticism that that the Affordable Care Act has gotten. Yet 50 years later, you look at it, you have to say that that program has been a tremendous success, don't you?
That's correct. And it is ironic that the same people who criticized Medicare 50 years ago have their counterparts criticizing the Affordable Care Act today. Medicare and Medicaid have really transformed the economic well-being of the elderly. Also part of the war on poverty was an increase in Social Security benefits. Many people today are too young to remember what it was like in the late 50s and 60s. When somebody retired from work in their 60s, they lost their health insurance at the very time when health bills were going up. So what happened? They either went without health care or their adult children paid for it. And so the beneficiaries of Medicare are not just today's elderly, but today's adults who don't bear the burden of paying for either the living expenses or the medical bills of the elderly. And when people say the war on poverty is a failure, the dramatic success of the war on poverty is the fact that poverty among the elderly today is lower than it is among working age adults. The elderly have a European-style safety net. Their Social Security benefits are indexed for inflation. The minimum wage is not indexed for inflation. And the elderly have universal access to Medicare, and workers don't have access to health insurance. That's what the Affordable Care Act is trying to do. So we certainly have not learned the lesson of 50 years ago about how government can reduce poverty among a group. And in fact, much of the resources that Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security spend have dramatically reduced poverty among the elderly.
800-642-1234, the number to call. If you get a busy signal, send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or post to the Joy Cardine Facebook page. That works as well. Let's go to the phones, and we'll start with Randy in Brookfield. Randy, good morning.
Hi, good morning. My thought is the bonuses to the CEOs is way out of line, and I have a perfect example. There was a merger, and several people were let go in an IT department that were working on a disaster recovery project. Then there was a bonus paid because of that, all the people that were let go because of the merger, and that bonus, half of it would have kept 60 people working on that project. 6 months later, that project, they were testing, and the computers were down for a full day. And what that amounted to was more money in one day lost than all the people that he got rid of. And the bottom line is the bonuses are just way out of line. The way that we pay executives is not really what they do. I can see half their bonuses even sometimes, but the kind of numbers we're talking about would keep a lot of people working, and the minimum wage would be no big deal, adding $10 on, because it just would cover so many of these problems. There's people not working strictly because of that. That's my comment.
Randy, thanks for those comments. Certainly, there's been a lot of discussion about executive compensation and people getting rewarded for laying others off.
I believe like it's a contract thing. You know, I think they got to figure out how those contracts are designed, because right now they're designed by other people that are doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. They got to be designed by stockholders or something somehow.
Okay, Randy, thanks so much for that. Sheldon Danziger?
I certainly agree. The explosion of executive pay, really without bound, is a phenomenon that is a key factor contributing to rising inequality. You know, the multiples of what the top executives get today compared to what they got 30 and 40 years ago is dramatic. You know, to make matters worse, there's this loophole called carried interest, where people in hedge funds are able to treat what most economists consider to be their earnings as capital gains, so they pay a much lower tax rate, compounds that. So it is very, very difficult to do that in a world in which corporate boards are interlocked and stockholders haven't had much of an ability to do much about executive pay. Again, the caller is exactly right. A lot of those bonuses, if they were, you could be very rich instead of very, very rich. And if the funds were provided to the workers, it would result in shared prosperity instead of what we've had, a period in which the economy grows and not much trickles down to the bottom half.
There's been a lot of discussion in the news recently about Pope Francis and his comments, his efforts to make poverty a front and center of the discussion, at least for Catholics. President Obama cited the Pope in a speech about income inequality last month. He used the line about how when a homeless person dies of exposure, it's not news, but when the markets drop 2 points, it is. So what sort of effect is Pope Francis having on public policy when it comes to helping the poor, do you think?
Well, I think it certainly has captured the attention of the public and politicians. When you have in the U.S., we talk about the president being able to use the bully pulpit. I think certainly the Pope's speeches on the topic have had that kind of effect. As I say, one would hope that in people of faith, when they listen to this, they might, particularly if their employers making those huge bonuses, might think, gee, I could take $10 million instead of $20 million this year and could do better by the workers with the other half of the bonus.
Yeah, on the other hand, you have people who say greed is good. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Sheldon Danziger. The origin of this discussion, President Obama is going to give an address this afternoon. He'll be talking about ways to continue to work on issues of poverty in America and to talk about how to reduce America's income gap, among other things. That was our launching point, and the discussion continues. 800-642-1234, the number to call. We have callers waiting to join us, and we'll get to them in just a moment. My guest, as I said, Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The War on Poverty. President Johnson started it. Some say President Roosevelt started it with Social Security. President Johnson talked about it, and a lot of programs were started under his presidency. We've talked about Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, all of those things. President Obama's giving a speech this afternoon where he's expected to outline his plans for fighting the war on poverty. We're talking about that and other related topics this morning with Sheldon Danziger, president of the Russell Sage Foundation, which researches social inequality, low-wage work, immigration, and behavioral economics. He's written several books, including Legacies of the War on Poverty, which was published last year. Well, President Obama is also calling on the federal is calling for the federal minimum wage to be bumped up to $10.10 an hour. Critics say that'll just cause the prices of goods and services to go up, which means that fewer people will buy those things, and that means businesses will make less money. Okay, so that seems to be a pretty familiar argument, Sheldon Danziger, when we talk about raising the minimum wage. That's the first thing that some people talk about.
People who advocate that would like us to go back to a $2 minimum wage. There is, first of all, I should say, business profits as a whole have soared since the end of the Great Recession, and wages certainly haven't. I mentioned that the 50th percentile, we're not just talking about the lowest wage workers, have had no wage growth really since the late 1990s. Yes, prices would go up some. Yes, there would be a small reduction in total employment. But overall, poverty would go down, and a lot of low-income families would have a little bit more cushion and less economic hardship. And one of the things that would happen is fewer people would be on food stamps, and the amount of food stamps that many workers get would go down. So taken as a whole, the benefits greatly outweigh the cost. Now, a $20 minimum wage, that would be disruptive. But moving to a $10 minimum wage is about the same in inflation-adjusted terms as it was back when President Johnson raised the minimum wage in the late 60s, and the economy as a whole is roughly twice as rich. So we can certainly afford to have the minimum wage keep up with inflation in a world in which the aggregate amount of income has doubled.
Let's take some calls. We'll go first to Karen in Shorewood. Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for this program. It's very informative. And with regard to the, I have a couple of points I'd like to make. And my most important one, well, maybe my second most important one, is with regard to the minimum wage. Not only should it be raised, but it should be indexed to inflation. And politicians never wanted that because they want to get credit either for raising it or whatever. But we always have this contentiousness. So it should be raised and it should be indexed to inflation. And I think the objections that so many people in government power have to all these programs is really just an excuse for doing nothing. I think back to RFK, who really did not understand the poor, but he was transformed when he went to Mississippi. He was a different person. None of these people who are doing nothing in Washington come face to face with people. So I guess I'm with the Pope on that one. You should smell like the sheep. And the other thing, last thing, I think we should get rid of the ideas, these wars. War on poverty, war on cancer, war on drugs. They're doomed to failure. We need something else. I don't know. Operation Access to the American Dream. I don't know. I can't come up with anything sexy. But this war stuff is ridiculous. So anyway,
Karen,
I appreciate your comments on that.
Karen, thanks thanks so much for the call. Sheldon Danziger?
Well said. I agree with the caller.
I
do think that in retrospect, it would have not using the war analogy probably would have been a good idea. But unfortunately, I think we're stuck with that. But in general, I totally agree with what the caller just said.
Karen, thanks for the call. Let's go to Derek in Appleton next. Derek, good morning.
Thanks for my call. All right. Thanks for taking my call. I was just listening to Karen speak, and I couldn't help but to think about what it is that I wanted to say about all these wars and these failed wars on poverty and on drugs and on terrorism, for that matter. I mean, we are the biggest spender for military spending with 39% of the world spending. Why don't we take 20% of that money and put it towards our people? I mean, I think that would go a long way. I mean, there used to be a much larger promise zone here in America. It used to be just America. Why don't we just stop all these wars and get some common sense and start taking care of our own people? Thanks for my call.
And thanks so much for sharing that. So if we cut military spending, would we actually be able to apply any of that to relieving poverty, do you think, Sheldon Danziger?
Well, there are two issues. One is that the forces that promote military spending are much more powerful than the forces that promote spending on the poor, so that even in an era, if we go back to the end of the Cold War, when we did cut back on defense spending, it was always very difficult to do so. It's proven very difficult to close bases, even when the military says we don't need to close these bases, because they're obviously in someone's congressional district and people in that district don't want that base closed. So the discussion of how much the military budget should be is something that I don't have an expertise on, but I would just point out that there would be people who would say, even if I'm going to vote for cutting the military, I want that money to go to tax cuts, not to spending on the
mm-hmm. You wrote an opinion piece last year that the census numbers that we have seen don't tell the whole story about poverty. What else should we know about the poverty rate between 2011 and 2012?
Well, we've been talking about the broad picture about the war on poverty, and one of the reasons that people think the war on poverty has failed is that the way we measure poverty is outdated, and almost everybody agrees on that. And the best example is that today more than 40 million people get food stamps, and you get food stamps on a debit card, and it operates pretty much like cash, other than that you have to spend it on food, and yet our poverty measure doesn't count food stamps because it was developed before food stamps were there, so it counts money income. And many researchers, including those in Wisconsin, have shown that if you simply count food stamps and the earned income tax credit against the poverty line, poverty is lower than revealed. So people using the official poverty line, people say, well, poverty was 19% when President Johnson launched the war on poverty. It's 15% today, not much progress. If we added these benefits, it would be 11%, so there'd be twice as much progress. Poverty would still be high, but it would be 8 points lower than in 1964 rather than just 4 points lower.
So what would it take in the war on poverty for us to be able to hoist a mission accomplished banner? What would victory in the war on poverty look like?
Well, the best example I could give would be we have a view that people who work hard and play by the rules shouldn't be poor. President Clinton talked a lot about that. And the way we've tried to do that is by combining wages plus food stamps plus the earned income tax credit. So the first way is a minimum wage increase, and the president's talking about that. The other is we act as if people can get a job if they just go out and work. So those who criticize the extension of unemployment insurance say, well, the problem is unemployment insurance subsidizes people to stay at home. And because they get $300 a week in unemployment insurance, they won't take jobs. But you can find people like that. But by and large, the reason people are unemployed is because firms have decided they don't want to hire the long-term unemployed. So looking for a job doesn't mean you're going to find an employer who will hire you. So it seems to me, given our strong belief in work and our strong belief that you should work hard to support your family, we ought to have some sort of stopgap program in which you are unemployed and you say, look, I have been looking for work for 6 months and I have applied to these many places. No one is going to hire me. Well, we ought to have some sort of job of last resort. Could be a minimum wage job doing things in the public sector. It could be with private firms. It could be with nonprofits. Some of this was tried during the stimulus bill, and many states with Republican and Democratic governors liked this kind of program. And then you could say, okay, your unemployment insurance is over, but if you really are willing to work, here's this low-wage job of last resort.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's better than cutting people off.
Yeah, and that's where we're speaking of cutting people off, we're going to have to end the program here. Thank you so much, Sheldon Danziger,
sure,
for an interesting hour. Sheldon Danziger is president of the Russell Sage Foundation. Bill Martin's produced this hour of programming. Christy Taylor and Christy Taylor and Robin Cherry handled on-air production for me this morning. Memory impaired again. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.